Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. An Iowa AAU coach is waiting for trial on child pornography charges. A former elementary school teacher in Northwest Iowa was arrested in October and charged with having sexual contact with an 11-year-old boy. These high-profile cases are shining a much-needed light on the persistent and horrifying problem of childhood sexual abuse. This hour, we're going to explore the problem, talk about where the dangers are for our children, talk about prevention and how to help survivors move forward. My first guest today is Rosanna Beccari. She was abused as a child. She's the author of the memoir Too Much Love Is Not Enough and the founder of the nonprofit Talking Trees, an organization dedicated to helping and empowering adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse and incest. And she is on the line with me right now. Hello, Rosanna.
Good morning. Thanks for allowing me to be part of the conversation.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And I've used the statistic that one out of every 10 children will be sexually abused before they turn 18. And I know that there are a number of different statistics that come from different places. And I think it's impossible for us to fully understand how prevalent this problem is. But give me an idea. What should we know about how prevalent sexual abuse is?
Well, there's two numbers that I think are really important. The most current numbers that we use consistently is now one out of six for girls and one out of eight for boys before they reach the age of 18. And as you say, people collect those stats differently, sometimes based on what has been brought to light, based on the level of contact or invasion, some reports don't count if it's visual, if it's making a child watch pornography. Some numbers include those sort of statistics and some numbers don't. So it really varies on how we define sexual abuse and what gets reported and how it gets reported and who it gets reported to. So the numbers that we sort of agree on in the field right now are one in six and one in eight. And so that number has gone down over the last decade. That's why that's so important. That being said, we also know that there's close to 60 million adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse, like myself, in America today. That number will never go down. So even if we stop sexual abuse today, that would be wonderful. There still remains all these adult survivors who are living in silence and never speaking about the trauma that they experienced. So,
well, and let's also unpack some of these numbers a little bit. I mean, we know that 15% of the victims are younger than the age of 12.
And yes.
You know, we also know that the primary perpetrators are people these children know and trust. Tell me more about that.
Right. So approximately 80% of children are victimized by people in their family, and then another percent, 10%, by people that are close to their family. So only 10% of children who are violated by strangers, people they've never met before. So that's huge. Oftentimes, they live in the same household as children do. So you rarely hear the word incest, which is so important for me to tag that on to shed light on the fact that these are trusted members. Because oftentimes, a lot of the ways that we talk about childhood sexual abuse, especially when it comes to prevention, really focus on this continued myth of stranger danger. And the problem is the boogeyman is already in the house. And so we have to, if we're concerned about prevention, which I know we all are, we have to be more open about who the violators really are and who we're trying to get children to protect themselves against, which is a whole other issue.
And
so it's pretty prevalent and pretty important.
I know you've shared your story many times in many ways, and we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about it today, but so people can understand, tell me What happened to you?
My first experience of sexual violation occurred at age 7 by my oldest brother, who was age 18 at the time. And it was once. I have very little memory of that event, and I thoroughly addressed that issue in the book. But it was, so I can't tell you exactly how that was addressed. I can tell you that however it was not appropriate enough to stop the sexual abuse to happen again later on. So I was also molested for 2 years by an elder cousin that lived with us. And then also at the age of 18 by another relative. So when these issues are not addressed and there's something that's going on in that environment, then, and if it's not addressed, it's because there's something else going on in that environment. And whatever is going on in that environment that allowed the first violation to occur leaves the door open for subsequent violations to occur. And so that's exactly what happened.
So many children who are abused will be abused again.
Yes. The greatest predictor for childhood sexual abuse or and into adulthood, actually, is previous sexual abuse. It's counterintuitive. Like, people kind of think, well, and it's also counterintuitive for those of us who experience it, because we leave with the idea that, oh, it's something must be wrong with us if this keeps happening. So it's difficult for us to process that information, too, before we get on the healing path. What does happen is that normal development does not take place. So, again, whatever happened, that situation did not get resolved, leaves the door open for more stuff, including how the victim then begins to see themselves, begin to see the world around them, and are experiencing those environments where people should be able to be trusted. So those internal resources don't develop to help build up those preventive measurements for people.
Well, and we talked about how usually in most cases the perpetrators of childhood sexual abuse are people that the children know and trust and love in many cases.
Yes.
So that
absolutely.
That leads to or involves so much more emotional pain as well. And I have to believe that also really gets in the way of dealing with a problem and moving forward.
Yes. Yes. Silence is a convenient tool for people in that environment. So most of the time when children are identified, it's because the violator was a stranger. So about approximately only 15 to 20% of children are identified in childhood. And then the remaining 80 or so percent of us make it into adulthood without ever having those issues addressed. Most of us don't even have ever disclose that has been the case. So it becomes embedded trauma because you're trying to figure out the world in a very distorted way. And it's a lot to untangle when we finally find a healing path somewhere in our mid-40s.
What made you break the silence? How did that happen for you?
I was also in, well, there has been, and the book is really about all of my overt and covert attempts to break the silence. And it's very, very difficult and very challenging. So that I'm going to answer the question sort of a roundabout way, because it depends on what you mean by breaking the silence. Because I had tried that before,
mm-hmm.
The point where I definitively said, I can't live like this anymore, and decided to live openly. So that's when I say I finally broke the silence. But there were things before then, there were people I told before then, et cetera, et cetera. So at the moment where I decided that I was going to live openly for the rest of my life, and this was no longer going to be a secret, it was because I was still continuing to be in an environment with violators. And it just got to the point where, and people knew, I disclosed the abuse to significant relevant people who were also obviously related to the violators. And the only recourse was nothing. Nothing was going to happen. Like, oh, okay, we know that. And that's it. No one ever considered to make allowance for me as a victim. So I was continuing to literally buy Christmas gifts. Then, you know, eat holiday meals with Violet. And my assumption was that I was supposed to absorb all of this because everyone made it sound like that was the normal thing to do. And it just comes to a point where your heart just can't take it anymore. Your mind can't, your heart can't. And for me, that's what happened. Like, I just literally could not stand a thought of one more meal with a violator. I just couldn't do it anymore.
So what does it mean to you to live openly as a survivor of childhood sexual abuse? How did that change your life?
For me, it meant, and how we define it in Talking Trees, it just means that you let go of the secret. Once you in your mind decide that you're no longer gonna live carrying this secret, however that unfolds for you, it unfolds for you. But when we carry the secret, we intentionally live with this tension and this hope of no one ever finding this thing out. So it means conversations change, simple conversations, fun conversations, where a group of girls are sitting around chatting and everybody talks about their first kiss. What do? You have to alter that conversation because that's a big secret. No one must allow that. When someone asks how come you walk out the movie theater when a certain scene comes up, you have to alter that conversation. You have to pretend like you suddenly have to go to the bathroom because there is a scene in a movie that you can't watch. So you're constantly altering your experiences to avoid these conversations or avoid the truth that you live with in ways that often we're not even conscious about ourselves. Once you let go of the secret, you have much more room to speak your truth, and you don't have to hide that anymore. This is why I left the room. Oh, this was my first sexual experience. Really? Yeah, is that a conversation you're really ready to have? And so you let it go. It doesn't mean that you go out in the world and blurb out and hold out and wave a red flag. It just means that it doesn't mean that you go out and tell everybody. It just means that you no longer give a darn who knows.
Rosanna, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Rosanna Bakari. She's the author of the memoir Too Much Love Is Not Enough and founder of the nonprofit Talking Trees. It's an organization dedicated to helping and empowering adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse and incest. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. You are welcome to join us, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about child sexual abuse. It is a pervasive problem that has been a part of our culture for a very long time, continues to be a part of our culture, largely unseen. And we're talking this hour about what it's like to have experienced that, about how survivors can move forward. We'll talk about prevention as well. And you are welcome to join the conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me is Rosanna Bakari. She is the author of Too Much Love Is Not Enough. She's also the founder of the nonprofit Talking Trees, an organization dedicated to helping and empowering adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse and incest. And Rosanna, before we bring more guests into the conversation, I want to ask you, we've talked about how you made the decision to live openly as a survivor of childhood sexual abuse. You founded this nonprofit to bring adult survivors together, to give them a place, a safe place to talk about what they've experienced. And with so many people who are victims of a crime or survivors of a crime, we think about justice. We think about maybe a need to get an apology from a perpetrator, something like that. These are things that are not part of your story and not part of the story for so many survivors of child abuse.
Right.
So what does it mean to have to move forward without justice, without someone admitting or apologizing for what happened to you?
Some survivors do choose to go that route. Talking Trees, the healing journey that we outline, and I really do mean outline, is all about going within to try to take care of that inner child who actually did experience that. And so it's one of the things that happen with many adult survivors is that oftentimes we think that there's a thing that we can do. When we make the mistake of feeling like if someone apologizes, that's going to be it. If I forgive, that's going to be it. The reality of the healing journey is that there's so much work to be done. There's so many lies to uncover because most of us live in silence for so long. Like I said, the average age is about into the 40s when we begin to look at these issues. We've done so much distortion in our lives in order to survive. That so much of that has to be uncovered and untwisted and untangled, starting with our own definition of family for most of us. So there's so much work to do, and to try to move forward in that work with the assumption that if someone apologizes, something's going to get better. Oftentimes, that's not the case. Keep in mind that most of this occurs in families, so there's some dysfunction in that family. Even though it may be some joy, some great times, or there's some dysfunction in that family. And so if this is a family that wasn't willing to deal with childhood trauma, chances are this family hasn't gotten a lot healthier than what you've gotten as a survivor. So chances are no one's going to say, oh, right, yeah, we just forgot to apologize for that. So oftentimes what survivors find is that when they choose that route of trying to make someone respond to them in a specific way, the trauma gets deepened. So to avoid that, we really focus on trying to get survivors to take full responsibility for where their lives are, not by moving forward, but by willing to throw everything on the table to look at it from their own adult perspective where they are right now. Oh, you think that you have to be part of your family? Let's throw that on the table and throw it under the microscope. Oh, you think you have to forgive because that's what your religious customs say? Let's throw that on the table and look at it. What's healthy for you and what's not healthy for you? The stuff that's healthy for you and can help you put the pieces of yourself back together, we want to keep. Everything else, we want to get rid of. Like, so we try to go for what's really in the best interest of the survivor, not of culture, tradition, family, expectations, work, all that stuff, but really try to get survivors to detach as much as they can from the things that have gotten them to their point of where they are now that makes life feel so difficult for them. Because oftentimes that's because we're trying to hold on to stuff.
Right. And for you, that has meant creating distance with your family.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has been one of the most painful processes. And creating Talking Trees was a way for me to rebuild my whole definition of family. Mm-hmm.
I'm talking with Rosanna Bakari. She is the author of the memoir Too Much Love Is Not Enough and the founder of the nonprofit Talking Trees, an organization dedicated to helping and empowering adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse and incest. And I want to focus now on children who are experiencing this now and trying to get through it. And I want to bring Tori Hilton into the conversation. She is a forensic interviewer at Mercy Medical Center in Sioux City. Hello, Tori.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I've been talking with Rosanna about the fact that the majority of childhood sexual abuse is perpetrated by people children know and are often related to. In the kinds of cases that come to you, can you give me an idea of where the danger lies, where these cases are coming from?
I definitely think that it is kids are being perpetrated on by people that they do already know. I think historically we've talked to kids about being aware of strangers or people who do bad things, and there was really a lack of conversation going on about what happens if it's somebody that you know and maybe that you love and trust that's doing something to you that you just don't think is okay. Kids weren't really sure how to go about handling those things and knowing what to do in those situations. So there's really been a shift in talking to kids about sometimes even the people that you know and love can do things that aren't okay, and that's still okay to talk about. And we definitely see that here.
We have these high-profile cases in Iowa recently with the AAU coach who is charged with child pornography, the former elementary school up in northwest Iowa who is charged with having sexual contact with an 11-year-old boy. Of course, we have the Larry Nassar case, which has really focused a light on sexual abuse nationwide, worldwide, in fact. Are you seeing more people coming forward?
I think that's kind of hard to answer. What I would say is that there is a lot more awareness, absolutely, and a lot more courage to come forward, I think, because of the other victims that have been brave enough to come forward and join the Me Too movement or come forward with other kinds of abuse. I'm not sure that it's impacted our numbers directly. We see a pretty steady stream of kids regardless. But I do think the awareness and, you know, the bravery of those people to come forward is very heightened.
Rosanna and I were talking about the secrecy that surrounds childhood sexual abuse. Obviously, perpetrators don't want these secrets to get out. They often have a lot of power over the children in their lives. What are some of the signs that parents or teachers or other caregivers can pick up on that a child might be experiencing this? Because so often children can't tell you or won't tell you.
Absolutely. And it is definitely something that occurs in secrecy because secrecy is what allows it to continue. What I always say to parents and to caregivers is that they know their child the best. So if there's some type of sudden change in their child's behavior, they're saying things that maybe make you question where they got that information from, perhaps they're acting out at times. You notice when there's a shift in your child's behavior, what is not normal for them. So I think that definitely creates a red flag. A lot of times kids aren't coming forward and saying, this is what happened to me. We often see what we call accidental disclosure. And that's when somebody either witnesses something directly, perhaps a child does, you know, say something that raises a red flag or acts in a way that makes somebody question something. So they're not necessarily coming forward to say this is what happened, but people are starting to kind of discover that something's off.
Do we have an idea of how many of these sorts of cases go unreported?
That's really difficult to know simply because, you know, a lot of cases are delayed in the disclosure. So a delay in disclosure could be a day, it could be months, it could be years. There are studies where researchers are reaching out to people and asking about sexual abuse, and they report at that time that they had been sexually abused as a child and never told anybody up until adulthood. So I think it's really hard to say how many go unreported just because if they haven't said anything, it's difficult to collect those numbers. Delay is very, very common, however.
Well, and as we've said, children often can't tell, won't tell people what happened. How difficult does that make it to hold perpetrators accountable?
I would say it makes it difficult, definitely, just because if kids aren't coming forward with information, unless some of those accidental things kind of happen that raise red flags, oftentimes this goes unnoticed because of the secrecy and the different tactics that potential perpetrators use to get kids to comply with that secrecy and not telling. So it definitely makes it more difficult.
So what advice would you give parents and educators about teaching children? We'll talk a little bit more about the history of the whole stranger danger idea in a moment, but we do teach our kids to be wary of strangers. What should we be teaching them to be wary of so they can protect themselves?
We do a program in the schools that's called Speak Up, Be Safe. And what we talk to kids about during that program is that we talk to them about 5 different safety rules. And we talk to them about the ways that people might try to abuse kids. and the ways that they can then go forward and tell somebody about that. So I think just talking to kids and being open with them in communication to say, no matter who it is, if there's something that someone's doing to your body that's not okay, or just to you in general that's not okay, who are the safe people that you feel comfortable talking to? And that doesn't always have to be a parent. It can be a teacher or a coach or a counselor. So really having those conversations with kids, I think it's important to pay attention to who's spending time with your children. If there's somebody who seems to want to spend a lot of time with your child and it just doesn't quite make sense for them to do that, that's possibly a red flag. And to just, again, monitor your kid's behavior. And if you notice that shift, to ask some open-ended questions and just reassure your child that it's okay to talk about anything and that, you know, they're not going to be in trouble if something happened that wasn't okay.
Now, I think anybody who has spent time with young children know that they're not mini adults. They're not necessarily always rational. How do you help them understand what abuse is? Because they can have a really hard time drawing distinctions.
Absolutely. They're not mini adults, just like you said. And so to talk to them in a way that's appropriate for their age, we're going to talk to a 4-year-old a lot different than we are a 12-year-old. And to just reassure them that nobody should be doing things to their body. We encourage parents to have open conversations about what parts of our body are private, and to just continue to talk to them and check in with them repeatedly as they age in a way that's appropriate for their developmental level.
Something that I've talked to my children about is that most of the time an adult doesn't need them to keep a secret. Is that something we should warn children about, that people shouldn't be asking them to keep secrets from their parents?
Absolutely. We talk to kids about, you know, there are some secrets that are okay to keep. A secret about a present or a surprise party, those are secrets that no one is going to get hurt if people don't find out. And lots of times in those secrets, the goal is that somebody does eventually find out because they'll get the present or the party will happen. Now, secrets that are about child abuse, that, you know, somebody's going to get hurt if somebody doesn't find out about that secret, that's a secret that needs to be told. And we even tell kids that even if it's a secret of a friend, you know, a friend approaches you and tells you a secret that is about something with child abuse, that's a secret that needs to be brought to the attention of a grown-up.
Rosanna, is there anything you want to add to that conversation? I mean, when you think back about what you went through and what so many of the survivors that you work with went through, what would have helped?
I think the conversation that gets missed a lot is there is the assumption that children, and she mentioned the word comply, which is such an important word because there's such a difference between comply and consent, because we know children cannot consent. However, children often do comply. So much of the childhood sexual abuse occurs by way of grooming, and I don't think we've yet gotten into real conversations about grooming. And grooming, we call it grooming because it doesn't yield itself to many of the rules that we're used to saying. So people say things like, if someone makes you uncomfortable, well, grooming happens so that you're not uncomfortable. Well, if someone touches your body in a way that you don't think they should, well, grooming overrides so many things. Oftentimes, groomers groom the family or the school or the parents before they groom the child. Like grooming, so grooming, groomers go off their reputation. So they set up a situation where either the child's not going to be believed or the family is so desperate that even if the child is believed, they won't do anything. You wouldn't believe the number of survivors who will tell you, I know someone knew what was going on. Someone knew. The groomer groomed the family before they groomed the child. So I want us to be really more aware of that. And then the other thing is that it can be counterintuitive and harmful when we teach children to protect themselves, because groomers are very good at what they do. So here's a scenario related to my own situation. By the time children realize that boundaries have been crossed, if you have given me a 9-year-old the responsibility to take care of myself and not let people do these things to me. By the time I recognize what this person has done to me, I, the 9-year-old, the 7-year-old, the 5-year-old, I have failed in my charge. I failed. Not the groomer, because the groomer has given me a whole different narrative. I have failed. So we have to be careful about giving children instructions to protect themselves, because children, particularly in certain ages, age ranges, will experience a sense of failure if they stop that from happening.
Well, and that returns to what we were just talking about with the fact that parents need to be aware of who wants to spend time with their children and be very skeptical of that.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, we're going to take another short break. We will be back in just a moment. We're talking about childhood sexual abuse today, and with me is Rosanna Bakari. She was abused as a child. She's the author of the memoir Too Much Love Is Not Enough and the founder of the nonprofit Talking Trees. Also, Tori Hilton is here, forensic interviewer at Mercy Medical Center in Sioux City. We will continue our conversation in a moment, and you're welcome to join us. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about childhood sexual abuse, a problem that is far too prevalent. At least one out of every 10 children will be abused by the time they turn 18. The number is probably significantly higher than that. And with me today, Rosanna Bakari. She's the author of the memoir Too Much Love Is Not Enough, the founder of the nonprofit Talking Trees, an organization dedicated to helping and empowering adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse and incest. Tori Hilton is also here, forensic interviewer at Mercy Medical Center in Sioux City. And I want to read a letter that was sent by Gerald. He says, in the early 1950s, I was a young male teenager and was sexually molested by our minister. I told my parents what happened. They contacted the DCI and I was interviewed. Turned out I was the tip of the iceberg and he was charged, and one other victim were in court ready to testify. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 2 years. It turned out that he had served time before. Some on the church board knew about it when he was hired. My counseling was hopefully saving other children from him, but I'll never know, since he was a very gifted speaker and charmer. And, you know, Rosanna, you were just talking about grooming. You were talking about these trusted people in our lives. The experience that Gerald has, I know, is not an uncommon one. That has happened far too often in far too many places.
Absolutely. So the trust is built up, and we have to begin to have these more open dialogues. It's also one of the reasons why, for me, breaking the silence of adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse is so critical to this conversation, because the reason why we're going off some limited information is because the voice of adult survivors have been limited. So the stories that you collect, that I've collected from adult survivors over the last 7 years, is very different from what gets put out there in public about adult survivors. That's because there's so much silence around the issue that where we get our information from is not complete. So much of the information is based on children who have been identified that have, in many ways, a very different experience than all of the adults that grow up in silence and never get identified. So we know a lot more about grooming that hasn't been discussed yet. A lot of that shame and guilt that we've carried has been related to the grooming that we've never talked about. So we have to have this force of adult survivors who tell the real stories, the real experiences of what it's like to be in a groomed relationship with victims and survivors. And we have to be with victims and violators, sorry. And we have to be able to tell that without guilt, shame, and judgment. And until we create that platform for adult survivors, we won't have a full picture of what's required for prevention.
I want to go to the phones. Carolyn is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, good morning. I can very much identify with this discussion based on my personal experience. And I would just like to take a little bit different angle. I certainly agree with Rosetta about the grooming. I was a very, very young child and didn't recall the memories until I was an adult. So I've tried to understand it, and I think that one of the contributing factors in a child's mind is that in some families, parents like their child to think that they know everything that's going on in their child's life. You know, when you're a little person, you think that everything that happens to you, your parents know. It's just part of the way that a preschool-age child thinks. And so in my own mind, I thought, well, my parents must know that this is what's happening to me with this trusted relative who was supposed to be taking care of me. And therefore, if my parents knew about it, it must be okay. So I didn't say anything. And I've also studied this subject, and I agree with it on a personal level as well. If the person who's abusing that child is a close person to the adults in the family, children don't want to tell their parents things that they know will upset them. So they don't say what's happening because they know it will upset the adult. And so children don't disclose to the adults that they're closest to because they know, you know, how upset it will make the adult. And I just wanted to add that those thoughts about what may be going on in the minds of children, and I totally agree also with Rosetta's point about children see themselves as the one who has failed. They don't understand that it's the adult that has the problem.
Oh, Carolyn, thank you so much for sharing your experience, and I'm so sorry you had to go through that. I want to get Tori. Can you respond to what Carolyn was saying? Because I'm sure that when you're speaking with children who've been abused, this definitely comes into play.
It definitely comes into play. And so, you know, just first to reassure that when we do go out into the community and have a chance to talk with kids before they ever end up at our center, we definitely reiterate to them all of those things, that it's an adult's job to keep kids safe. And even though kids might know safety rules, it's still the job of the adults to keep the children safe. And so even when something bad does happen, it's never their fault. It's always somebody else that made a wrong choice. It's never the child. Now, regardless of having those conversations with kids, that comes up in a majority of the interviews, that I didn't want to tell my parents because I knew they would be upset. I thought maybe they wouldn't believe me. I didn't want the person to get in trouble, even though I didn't like what they were doing. I felt embarrassed. I felt ashamed. I felt like it was my fault. And I think that's totally part of the grooming process, is that, you know, someone who would perpetrate this kind of abuse on a child is making a child feel that way by saying things like, you know, we have a lot of fun together, and if you told somebody, then I might get in trouble and we won't get to spend time together anymore. Things like that. And just, you know, you were here too, and you didn't tell anybody, so maybe you were part of it. So I think that absolutely that's part of the grooming process, and it definitely delays the disclosure of kids because of that. They don't want to tell because they don't want to feel like maybe someone might think it was their fault.
Carolyn, thank you so much for your call. I want to bring Andy Kopsa into the conversation now as well. She's a freelance investigative reporter. She's done a great deal of research into sexual abuse and sex offender registries. She recently published a profile of a sexual predator through iowawatch.org. It's called The Boy on the Bus. Hello, Andy.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Sure.
And
no problem.
I want to talk about, you know, we've talked a lot about the fact that often it is people close to a child that perpetrates this kind of sexual abuse. You published a story that was a profile of a sexual predator, and your encounter with him when you were a child, he was still a child as well. It's called The Boy on the Bus. Tell me a little bit about what happened.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Iowa, and rode the school bus every day. And I was, you know, in kindergarten or so, and I believe he was probably about 16, so I would have been 5 or 6. You know, the visceral memory is the one that I open with in the piece, is that he, you know, I come into my family home crying, and my mom takes me aside and asks me what's wrong. I resist telling her what's wrong, but she says, you know, you're sweating through your clothes, you're scared, you have to tell me what's going on. And what it was, he had given me a card that was basically, looking back, now as an adult, I realize it was a threat. But it was a Christmas or a holiday card that was, you know, saying that he loved me and that he was going to give me a present, and that once he gave me a present, I would have to give him one too. And, you know, fortunately for me, my mom is that mom. So she, pulled me aside, got on the phone, called his mother, and really tried to reassure me that it wasn't anything that I did. So very clearly he scared me. And he continued to, off and on over the years that we were on the bus together, that he'd left me alone after that for a while. But, it was definitely in retrospect, I dodged a bullet, that this idea of grooming was not even in my vocabulary until the story came out that he had been arrested for sexual abuse of minors. So they're already in our circles. They're already, like, everyone is, like your guest said, it's like, the idea of stranger danger is, that's fine. But I think that to the guest point, to all of the statistics that we have, everything that we see, is that we already know who these people are. They're within our communities. They're on our bus. They're in our family. They're in our neighborhood, that's how I kind of came into researching this particular subject of sex offender registries.
So what do you think we can learn, when someone is identified as a perpetrator, they register on a sex offender registry, and that's of course sexual offenders that are not just abusers of children, but
sure.
for other crimes as well. What can we take away from what you learned about these registries and what they can or cannot do to protect our children?
Well, I mean, I'm glad you point out that the registries aren't just capturing information of people that abuse children. Although in my research, it seems like those are, it's parents that are sort of opting in to research those registries. But overall, I think people would be alarmed to find out, as I was sort of kind of blown away. And I work in this area. I do a lot of reporting on sexual assault survivors, trauma survivors. And I was really kind of blown away by the fact that the networks don't talk to each other. The sex offender registry, in theory, say in Iowa, should be linked up to the national sex offender registry. But again, that means that the parents have to be actively looking for the offender online. Studies have shown that there's not a deterrent aspect to registries. And like the person that I wrote about, he moved seamlessly from Iowa, where he did start within his family. And I'm, very grateful to two of his sisters who spoke with me about their experience. And then he branched out and moved to Minnesota, where he was ingratiated himself in a community and began babysitting, was finally arrested there and placed on a registry. Well, then he picked up and moved to Florida and, offended again. So I think that what I've learned is that, registries give a false sense of security, and that we have to think about it in a larger space. And we talked a little bit about Me Too. We've talked a little bit about, parental responsibility and, making kids comfortable in education. I think education is incredibly important, talking open and honestly about sex with your kids, even though sexual violence is not about sex, it's about power. But we have to be open and honest. We also have to challenge our policymakers to put their money where their mouth is when it comes to protecting children and making sure that the laws actually are in sync with what's really going on. We need to encourage adult survivors. To Ms. McCary's point is that when they come forward, I mean, so that when they come forward, say, 40 years later, as we saw in some recent elections, you know, they come forward 40 years later and say, this person assaulted me when I was a 14-year-old. You know, we have to trust and believe them, and we have to understand why it took 40 years and why it took this long or that long. You know, it's like I said, from my own personal experience, I dodged a bullet, and it wasn't until my mom sent me a link to a WHO TV interview with this particular offender that I was, you know, right back into that place of being this kid that felt terrified of this guy that went on to molest, you know, children. So, you know, I don't want to paint a bleak picture, but it's just the truth, you know. And I think that instead of registries, you know, catching the low level offenders, and what I'm talking about are some of these laws capture, you know, kids that are, you know, urinate in public like that. We need to make sure that we don't overload a system with names of somebody that happens to pee behind a dumpster or wherever it may be, with actual repeat predators, because that system is already taxed. It's falling, you know, it's failing, and there aren't enough resources to for local law enforcement to keep track of making sure everything gets where it's supposed to go online.
Well, and Andy, we are out of time, but thank you so much for talking with us today.
Sure.
Andy Kopsa, freelance investigative reporter. She's done a great deal of research into sexual abuse and sex offender registries and recently published a profile of a sexual predator through iowawatch.org. It's called The Boy on the Bus. Tori Hilton, thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Tori Hilton is a forensic interviewer at Mercy Medical Center in Sioux City. And Rosanna Beccari, in the minute that we have left, Andy brought up the Me Too movement. A lot of these stories of childhood sexual abuse, these aren't the stories that we've been hearing about in the Me Too movement. Do you feel like these stories are still not being told?
They're not being told fully, I will say, particularly the story of incest. The slime of the slither of hope that the Me Too movement gave us, initiated, and everybody was full force. And then there was this quick turn into sexual harassment, which is so important yet so different from dealing with the issues of childhood sexual abuse and incest. So we have a long way to go.
So you think we need a new movement?
I'm currently launching a We Too movement along with the book, where we're really trying to close the gap between survivors and listeners. And instead of asking survivors to continue to identify with a We Too mission, the number two is asking listeners to identify. So we're trying to push forward much more information about what it means to be a listener.
Rosanna Beccari.
And asking people to identify.
Yeah, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation.
Rosanna Beccari is the author of the memoir Too Much Love Is Not Enough. She's also the founder of the nonprofit Talking Trees, an organization dedicated to helping and empowering adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse and incest. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.